Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum. Tonight's lecture is part of our Monday night philosophy series, and tonight I'm giving my annual March lecture, and I'm speaking on Plato's radical respect for reason. So, one of the important things to know is a lot of people, when they talk about the ancient Greeks and so on, they say that they invented reason, or that it's the first time that anybody ever did this, and so on. And there is something first about it, but it's not that they invented reason, of course. Reason's been around forever. In fact, animals all use reason, you know, in making decisions, too. They have to decide whether to get their food here, from here, from not. We don't really know, obviously. We spend a lot of money and effort trying to find out how aliens, if aliens are going to communicate with us from other planets, but we can't even communicate with the thousands and thousands of species right here. How do we know? Maybe whale songs are their version of TED Talk. They might be talking about something that's interesting. They might be talking about reason, but we just don't know that. But we do know that they use reason. Now, what was it that Plato did that was very, very different? Well, let me tell you a little bit about his life, so that you have a background on him, because not too many people know much about his life. And because he did such abstract thinking, people don't think of him as very human. In fact, a lot of followers later on made him semi-divine and all that kind of stuff. And that obviously just gets in the way of our ability to understand what he's up to. So I'm going to try to bring him down a little bit. So Plato was a young man from a very rich family, a very aristocratic family in Athens, at the time that Socrates was, you know, at his height. Near the end, actually, the last 10, 15 years of Socrates' talking in the forum in Athens and getting people to think about things. So let me give you just one short idea about Socrates first, so that you know one thing about the teacher. His teacher was famous, very famous, in Athens. And why? Well, when he was a young man, he had been in the military. Socrates had been in the military as a young man. He'd been very brave in the fighting. And after that war, he was in town, and he was a sculptor who worked in sculptures. Somebody had traveled from Athens to the Delphic Oracle. Everybody know what the Delphic Oracle was? Yeah, so that was the thing at the time that told everybody what they should believe about everything. So the Delphic Oracle said to this traveling Athenian, the wisest man in Athens is Socrates. So this businessman, so most of the travelers to the Oracle were businessmen looking for hints on when to, you know, which day should I take my trip across the Mediterranean so that I don't get destroyed by one thing or another. But they asked other questions too, so this guy had asked that question. So he went back to Socrates and he said, Socrates, the Delphic Oracle is saying that you're the wisest man in Athens. And Socrates said, the Delphic Oracle must not know what it's talking about. Now, that was not a very clever thing to say at the time, but but that's what he said. But about 10 or 15 years later, he said, I thought about it and everything. I think maybe I have an idea why they said that. Why did they say that I was the wisest man? Well, it's because I've noticed that almost everybody walks around thinking that they know what they're talking about, and they don't. They don't really know what they're talking about. Every time I ask them questions, they can never give me a good answer for why they believe what they believe or even what it is that they do believe. So I said, maybe I'm the only one who knows that I don't know. And if I know that I don't know, I must be wiser than the ones who think that they know when they don't. And that was his conclusion. Okay, so maybe I am the wisest based on that one thing. So that's the kind of teacher he had. Now, it's very important, you know, and I'll get into this a little bit later too. It's important to discriminate between Socrates and Plato. They're two different things. It was the habit of people in ancient times to put everything in the mouth of their teacher as a pretend humble thing, but also a way of giving it more credence than if you just said it yourself. And so in Plato's dialogue, Socrates says a lot of things which Socrates never said in life. And I'll go into that a little bit later. But Plato was a young man, probably started listening to him in his teens. At the time that Socrates died from drinking hemlock, which was his punishment for having taught young people like Plato to not worship the gods or not treat the gods the same way as they had before. So at that time, Plato was 27 years old, something like that, late 20s. Ironically, some of the dialogues that he wrote, like his Socrates drinking the hemlock and the great speeches that he made and everything, well, it's very clear for the dialogues that Plato actually was not there for that. He was sick that day. So he collected information from other people and reported on it. And, of course, probably was very good at making up speeches, as a lot of people were, so that maybe it wasn't exactly it. But he had heard Socrates say a lot of those things before. So it's important to remember also that Plato's family was extremely influential, as I said, and two of his uncles were among the 30 tyrants that ran Athens during the time that put Socrates to death. So his family was not only influential, but they were also influential in this area too. And he had nephews and cousins and so on. So when Socrates died, his family being well connected about the whole thing, they sort of hinted to him that, you know, the heat's on, you're on the target list, disappear, basically, if you want to survive. So he did. And one thing that's not, you know, Plato hasn't recorded many regrets in his dialogues, but one of his regrets is that he never married, that he wanted to get married and he didn't. And the reason was that when he was in his late 20s at this time, he was engaged to someone and he had to break up with that sweetheart because he had to leave. And, you know, he wasn't going to try to hold her because he didn't know when he was going to get back. So he leaves and he traveled around. And where did he travel? He traveled, it's not completely known, but it's quite well documented that he traveled to most of the Greek colonies that were in Sicily and in the lower part of Italy, what's called Magna Graecia at the time. Those were all areas where Pythagoras had started his theories and his followers and so on and so forth from 150 years earlier. Plato was very interested. He was also looking for books. Now, there were no books allowed by Pythagoras, and there was not supposed to be any writing. This is one of the ironies of Plato's writing, for example. Plato has a dialogue where he's recording Socrates explaining why you shouldn't write down anything that's being discussed about philosophy. Right? And of course, Plato is obviously writing this down. He's obviously not following what his teacher said about exactly that one point because he's recorded him as saying the opposite. And it was the common thing. This was, you know, one of Plato's radical acts was to say, no, it should be written down. And people had argued that we will have a better and clearer idea about our ideas if we just remember them and pass them on and discuss them. But Plato thought, no, writing, it's like adopting a new technology almost. Writing is getting a lot better. We can you know, keep copies, we can make copies, and then the copies and copies, and so we can kind of tell what the original was. And so he began to think, no, if we write it down, even though there will still be plenty of errors, and people will try to change them, it's still better than not writing it down at all. So that's one of his big radical acts, is to write it all down. Another act that's radical, and I'll go into a little later when I talk about the dialogues too, is that he didn't just tell you what he thought. He told you what everybody thought. He told you all the best arguments for another guy. I don't know how many of you have met somebody who's so interested in philosophy that when they discuss an idea with you and you're saying, okay, well, this is my argument, and they say to you, well, actually, your side of the argument has an even better argument than that, and let me give it to you, right? There are people who do that, but very, very few. And so that really is the sign of somebody who is a philosopher, a real lover of wisdom, and saying, no, you have a better argument. There are other ways of looking at this. In a way, his dialogues, which drive people crazy, I understand that, drive a lot of people crazy when they read them, because he doesn't come to a conclusion. He ends up sometimes 50 pages later, right back where he started. But in the meantime, he's gone all the other byways. And what did he basically do is he made a literary art form out of what we do when we think about something. We're trying to understand something. And we turn it over and turn it over in our mind and turn it over in our mind and turn it over in our mind. Look at this argument, look at that. And he turned it into a dialogue between lots of different people in order to investigate which arguments are good and which ones aren't, and to put it down in a way that other smart people could read those and then make comments on them and make some progress, because there wasn't a lot of faith that any progress could be made. That's where his radical respect comes from. Well, let me go back to his story. So he traveled to these other places, and he was, as I said, late 20s. And he was gone almost maybe 10 years, maybe a little bit more than 10 years. He traveled, among other places, to Syracuse. Syracuse is a city right on the southeastern tip of Sicily. And there was a dictator there named Dionysius. Dionysius being a very popular name. There's lots of people with that name. And his son's name was Dionysius as well. And the uncle's name was Dion. So if you get these things confused, don't worry about it. They have very, very similar names, like John, Johnny, and Jonathan, all at the same place. He met this dictator, and he did all right with him. He got a little aware. He really got on with the uncle, the nephew of the uncle, that is, the son of the dictator. He was his tutor for a while, a little like Aristotle later on was the tutor for Alexander. So that was what did, but something went wrong after a couple of years there, and so he got kicked out. And he traveled to other Pythagorean towns, towns where there were Pythagorean strongholds. And among the places he went to was a place called Tarentum. Tarentum is on the inside of the boot in Italy now. And there was a leader, a Pythagorean there, who was a political leader as well as a famous mathematician named Archytas. Archytas is still well known for his mathematical work, not, you know, quite as well known as Archimedes and Euclid, but he made some real strong proofs, and he lived at the same time as Plato, as I said. So they were both young men at the same time, and they became good friends. And that comes in a little later. Now, I'll just say one thing about the Pythagorean group. It wasn't very big, not very many people involved. But one thing that they were really known for and that set them apart was that they were really strong on friendship. Friendship was a really big issue with Pythagoras. So they tried to make sure that they proved that they were friendly as, you know, with each other and other people as well as Pythagoreans. And one of the stories that was told, it was told by the Syracusans about this, was that there were two Pythagoreans that traveled through Syracuse, and the dictator arrested one of them because he had violated one of the local laws against vagrancy or something like that. So they arrested him, brought him in, and said, "You forfeited your life." And the guy said, "Well, you know, okay. But first, if you don't mind, I'd like to go back to my home," which was, you know, a couple of days away, "and get all my affairs in order." These were young men, early 30s. "Get all my affairs in order, and then I'll come back." And the dictator said, "Yeah, right. Of course he'll come back." And his friend said, "Well, I'll stand as surety for him. I'll stay here. You can imprison me. And if my friend does not come back and get executed, to be executed, then you can execute me instead." And the dictator said, "Right." And he said, "No, I will." So he took him up on it. It was just such an unusual and novel thing to hear from any human being. He took the person, he arrested, took his friend, put him in prison. The guy left. And what shocked the dictator more than the fact that the friend had made that offer was that the friend that went home and settled his affairs came back to get executed, as he said he was going to. So the dictator then wanted to know all about this idea of friendship and how you got this, and he eventually let them both off. Okay, that's the story. I have a feeling that ending was added by the Pythagoreans. They probably both got killed because they didn't want to have to deal with seeing somebody who looked so good, you know, and made him look bad that they behaved like this. But in any case, that's the way the Pythagoreans tell the story. And the reason that I also tell it is because there's a similar thing between Archytas and Plato. So Plato traveled and said, you know, collected books. He had money as a rich, wealthy aristocrat. And he bought these Pythagorean books, very, very rare, that wherever he could find them, and asked people, "Are there any others?" And he went around collecting them. So he's a little bit of a book collector. I don't think he knew at the time that he was going to start the university, the academy, but those books all became valuable resources for the university he started, as we call it, the academy. He heads back at about 40 years of age to Athens, and he sets up the academy. And at first, it's just a school, just like Socrates's, where, you know, instead of at the forum, he's in this one place, and the young men come to listen, and they all discuss ideas and stuff like that. And then over time, it became something like the graduate schools at our universities now, something like that, so that the people would come and discuss ideas and work on their research and papers. One of his students was Aristotle. You know, if anybody thinks that they've spent too long in grad school, you should remember that Aristotle spent 18 years in grad school with Plato. You can really spend a lot of time if it's interesting. So that's that part of his life. And then when he was around 60 years old, he got a call from Dion. Not a call, obviously. He got a letter that probably took 2 or 3 months to get to him, from Dion, the uncle of, and said, "The old dictator has died, and the young guy that you were the tutor of is the new dictator. So you have a chance to make a philosopher king." You know, Plato was already known for talking about what we really need is philosopher kings to run places, and then humanity will be better off. Plato took him up on this, and he traveled to Syracuse again. Same sort of thing happened, though. The new dictator, the young man who had been his tutor, was delighted to see his tutor again, but when his tutor started telling him on how to behave and how to live his life again, he didn't like that too much because, you know, hey, I'm the king now, and you're nothing. So he actually arranged for a trial of Plato, and accused him, basically, not too dissimilarly from what happened to Socrates. But he didn't want to kill his tutor outright in front of everybody because Plato was fairly well known and fairly appreciated. Now, I say fairly well known. You know, he wasn't famous like he is now. But he was known as a thinker, maybe the way Francis Fukuyama is here. You know, people have heard his name, stuff like that. So he said, "Okay, you can go back. You're arrested. And this is the prison ship that you're going to be put on in order to row things." You know, he had to like basically be a slave on a prison ship, Plato. But what he didn't tell Plato was that he told the captain of the ship that he should throw him overboard, you know, and make sure that he dies. So at that time, it was a ship going back to Athens. And I don't know if you know about how the ships traveled at that time. They were really very, very good ships, but they didn't really cross across the Mediterranean Sea, the way ships do now with their engines and stuff like that. They stayed fairly close to shore, so they would stay 4 or 5 miles offshore. They didn't go too close because you can get shipwrecked that way. But they stayed 3, 4, 5 miles off the shore and traveled up that way. And so if you're in Sicily, then you go up the boot, you come across, then you go across the water and you come down the coast and so on and so forth. So when they were, you know, in the area of the boot, they threw him overboard. He's in his 60s. And he swam 3 miles to shore. But he was pretty exhausted by the time he got there. But he actually swam all the way to shore and survived. And he actually landed on the beach not very far away from where Pythagoras had ended his life 150 years earlier. So he collapsed on shore, and somebody came by and, you know, resuscitated him and everything like that. Found out who he was, knew that there was somebody in Tarentum, which was maybe 50 miles away. Sent someone there. That was Archytas. Archytas came and got him and brought him back and helped him recover for several months. So this friendship that had started 30 years ago between two thinkers was concluded that way. And when Plato recovered, he went back to Athens. And then he didn't travel anymore. Now he was 67. He probably thought, I really don't want to do that, swim again. So for the last 15 years of his life, basically, because he lived to be about 80 years old, he taught in his academy and finished his books. You know, he wrote the Laws at a pretty late stage, maybe even early 70s, something like that. So anyway, that's the outline of his life. I'm sure the last 15 years were not so dramatic, and I'm sure he liked that. But let's talk about now his ideas, the things that kind of drive people crazy, his dialogues. As I said earlier, the dialogues mostly don't come to conclusions. People find that very frustrating. There's lots of little nuggets of information and even really good observations and et cetera, a lot of jokes. You know, even if it's a really good translator, they capture some of the jokes, but a lot of it were linguistic jokes and so on and so forth. And even if you read ancient Greek, you probably wouldn't get all the jokes, because if you were writing today and you made a joke about Katy Perry, you know, 200 years from now, people wouldn't quite understand who this Katy Perry was or why she was who it was. And so all kinds of cultural references disappear over time. And even if someone's really good and footnotes some of them, I mean, it's almost impossible to reconstruct the cleverness and the jokes that are going on. But that was what he liked doing. He liked making a lot of jokes, a lot of linguistic jokes. So and he puts put a lot of ideas in it. One of the things that he does is he eggs himself on in his dialogues. He likes to push himself because he knows he's doing something radical and unusual. He's pushing the idea of how far you can push reason. And he knows that. So he's aware of that, and he's kind of like, there's nobody telling him he should be doing this, so he tells himself he should be doing this. You know, he eggs himself on. So the dialogues try to come to definitions. What is friendship? What is virtue? What is justice? The dialogue on the Republic is all about what is justice. Now, it goes into a large number of other things of how a city should be created and so on. And I think there's something very interesting about that process. And I think it gave at least me an insight into trying to understand Plato. He writes the Republic as if he's trying to create a place where he personally would be comfortable living. It's very clear from all the questions he asks and the fact that Socrates gets killed. Socrates and his friends, you know, are aware that people are saying all kinds of things, pretending they know when they don't know. And so, you know, when you're that kind of person, you're usually not excessively comfortable with everybody around you in society and saying, yeah, I really fit in here. It's enough when you challenge people's assumptions, like one or two of their assumptions about life. They don't like that. When you challenge every single one of their assumptions, you're really not popular generally, except for with the young men who find it really fun to get armed with that kind of thing and go back home to their conversations with their fathers and make the fathers feel that they don't really know what's going on. That's an ancient game that's still being played. So there is a value to what, you know, why the young men were involved. And if you see who ended up staying with it, you can tell that, you know, just like graduate school and undergraduate today, 90% of the people that are involved are there for the parties, you know, and for other elements of what's going on. And only a few of them are there for the real ideas, really grab it and go with the ideas. And of course, there were plenty. But when people, you know, the British were so fond, in the 19th century, the British were so fond of the ancient Greeks and thought that this was the height of all civilization, right? That there were archaeologists that liked to go to ancient Greece trying to dig up their skulls so that they could say, see, their skulls are bigger and so on and so forth, and that's why they were smarter. They had to have a whole bunch of reasons. But if you went through all of the contributions of ancient Greece to Western civilization, It was probably 200 people that did that. It wasn't the whole society. It was probably 200 people, and I'm sure they weren't looking at the right skulls. So, and people have had Einstein's brain for a long time and haven't found anything there that was useful. So that's really probably not the thing. But anyway, this is how we look to the past and try to uncover it. And I try to look to the past and say, no, it's much more like we are today, and there are some unusual things going on, and let's talk about those unusual things. So Plato was much more usual than we think of him. That's the first point. But when he was confused about these things and tried to look at it from all sides, he loved putting down all these ideas. Now, what was he aiming for? What was the emotional driver? Because there's always an emotional driver for these things. And the emotional driver for Plato was to come up with an explanation that made some sense. He wanted an explanation, and he knew that some things could make sense. He had caught the enthusiasm from Pythagoras that some things could be made to make sense. Pythagoras proved a squared plus b squared equals c squared. As I've said before, I won't go into it in detail. Before that, it was known that that was a relationship that was accurate. But Pythagoras figured out how it could be proved at all times. Now, philosophers and religious leaders at the time, they have all, and from times before that, they were always interested in the absoluteness of any idea, to gain absolute certainty. And there's this idea of the absolute Brahman in Vedanta theories, and there's the idea of nirvana in Buddhism, and there's the idea of a state of perfection. There's the whole idea in ancient Greek culture of the perfectibility of man. Can we be made perfect? All those ideas are very strongly related, and they're related because people were trying to get a hold of something that made complete sense. And Plato is a very interesting combination of two major strains of thought. One of this is this absolute, this certainty theory that a lot of people had done, and his own new skepticism. That skepticism was partially Pythagoras and even pushed much further by Plato. And the skepticism was maybe the way that we've been doing this has not been accurate. Maybe our ideas have not been accurate. That we can pull apart those opinions and make them fall apart. We know we have a lot of authority for those opinions. But do we have any reason to believe those authorities or to believe those ideas? That was the question, which was radical. Can we really question both the ideas? Because as soon as you start to question the ideas, you start to question the authority of the people whose ideas, who passed those ideas on and said these are true. So that's what Plato was doing. That was his radical act, one of his many radical acts. And in looking at this, what did he come up with? He came up with something that we now take for granted in a very simple way, but it sounded mystical. Now, one of the ways that I talk about Plato and Pythagoras about this is that, and I mentioned before that animals reason too, right? So Pythagoras and Plato and the other early Greek philosophers are a lot like the first amphibians. You know, they walk up out of the water and they get on dry land, but they're still wet. They're still soaking wet. Okay, and that's the mysticism. They're walking out of mysticism onto dry land. The dry land is reason. And of course, they sound mystical to us. But it's actually really quite interesting that their emotional attachment to those mystical ideas was helpful. And I'll show you how. So how many have heard of Plato's eternal ideas theory? Okay, so that's a major function of what, you know, what he's known for, this eternal ideas theory. Another one of his ideas is the remembrance. I won't go into that time. I'm going to talk about the eternal ideas theory because it sounds very mystical. He said, well, there's this place of perfection where there are these ideas that never change, and this world is a bad copy. It's always a bad copy of those perfect ideas. And like any really interesting idea, he used it in many ways that are unnecessary. Just like materialism has been so successful in creating all kinds of goods for us, but we think so much of it that we think if you can't measure it, you can't know it, and since you can't know it, it probably doesn't even exist. It's a very interesting thing because our emotions are like that, and that theory has kind of just blanked out our emotions. Said, you know, they really don't exist. So much so that, you know, the Star Trek show and the thing had a character, Spock, who was so reasonable he had no emotions, right? That's the idea, that if you got too reasonable, you just wouldn't have any emotions. Not at all a very good analysis of where our emotions come from or how they operate. But if you think about this concept, about the eternal ideas, instead of that kind of mystical thing, I adjusted it a little bit, and I'll tell you how I did it. I was thinking about this, and I thought, why is it that Plato, Pythagoras, Jesus, Buddha, Leonardo da Vinci, and almost anybody who has done a lot in art or music or religion or philosophy or science, almost all of them have a feeling that we're idiots. You know, they look out at the rest of humanity and they basically say, how are we going to deal with this? How are we going to, we want to do something about this, the rest of humanity, but they really are very hard to talk to, really hard to convey an idea to, really hard to, and so I thought about, why is it that that's true? And then I thought, okay, so at the other end of the spectrum in humanity, we have our psychopaths and our sociopaths, people who have no you know, real feel for other people's emotions at all, and so on and so forth. Have you ever talked to them and asked them what they think of humanity? They say, too good to be true, they're too naive, they're easily fooled, they're marks, all that kind of stuff, okay? Now, I stepped back from that and I said, you know, that's like a bell curve, you know? Here you get these people at this end and these people at this end. The humanity is this big bell curve of personality. And this end looks this way and sees everybody as being too good. This end looks this way and thinks everybody doesn't really, you know, everybody needs a 10-step program or a 12-step program or something to get them out of their insanity. And the people in the middle, you ask anybody, what's humanity like? Ah, everybody's all right, you know. Yeah, they have their weaknesses. Yeah, they might. Yeah, they do some things that I don't like. They're a little annoying, and my neighbor's really annoying. But in general, people are all right because they're all kind of like me. That's how you'd think if you were right in the middle, and that shows you where your perspective is on how you look at other people. So I said, step back. See what Plato did with the Republic is he's sitting out here and he imagined a society out here filled with people who don't exist. You know, who are very orderly, but very productive and nice and humane and so on and so forth. And he thought, oh, I'd like to live there. I'd be comfortable living there. And so he projected out, his imagination projected out. And then he said, okay, so if I want these people over here to fill this thing over here, what have I got to do to get him, you know, to change? Education was his answer, right? In the Republic, he explains exactly the detailed education he was going to give to the leaders so that they could be not greedy and not selfish and so on and so forth, so that they could lead society for the benefit of everybody without taking too much for themselves, right? So education, that's another thing that comes from Plato. The academy is considered one of the first universities, if not the first, idea of how to try to train minds in being more rational about how they think about things and more perceptive, more nuanced, et cetera, et cetera. So if we think about this eternal idea again that he had, yeah, it's dripping a little bit mystical, no question. But it's almost exactly the forerunner. In fact, I think it is the forerunner of our idea of a concept. What's a concept? A concept is the inherent pattern in something. We've seen, what's the relationship between things? And it's this pattern, okay? I'll give you an example, pi. It's in mathematics. Pi is the relationship, the relationship between the diameter of a circle and the circumference of a circle, right? And that's an exact relationship, but you cannot make it mathematically precise. So even though we can estimate it and we can approximate it and we can, you know, come to closer, you know, further and further numbers. I don't know, they've got a string of 100,000 numbers by now. So we can get close, and for all practical purposes, we only need about, you know, 4 points plus the decimal place, right? But there is something extremely precise about the concept, even though the mathematics isn't precise. That's what a concept is. Now, the interesting thing about it, does the mathematical relationship, which we define as pi, between the diameter of a circle and the circumference of a circle, as long as they're perfectly, you know, imagined, does it ever change? No, never changes. It's always going to be the same. Is a squared plus b squared equals c squared always the same? Always, always, always. So let's go back to eternity. Okay? So it's a very interesting thing that because it was filled with this sort of leftover thing, let's think about eternity from a different point of view. Because to me, the great benefit of studying Plato is to the methods that they used, and even the confidence they had that reason could answer questions. So now let's answer this question about eternity and time. It's really not that complicated. We are fooled by time because it's an arbitrary measurement that we do. right? We measure it to our emotions, to our feelings. It passes at different phases. It goes fast or goes slow, depending upon how bored you are here, whether this is, you know, going fast or whether it's going slowly. If you're watching your favorite movie, it goes by real quickly. If you've got a real stinker, you want to get up and, you know, change all the time. So it's still the same amount of time, but you feel the time passing differently. There's all kinds of theories about heaven. The time is different in heaven. Time doesn't exist in heaven. Or time is, you know, passing differently in nirvana, and so on and so forth. Okay, so let's see what time, you see, because we define the measurement, and the measurement can be adjusted. It's a little bit like saying, okay, we're going to define length in terms of a ruler. And the ruler we're going to make out of chocolate. And we're going to take that chocolate ruler, and we're going to go measure the diameter of a volcano. Okay, so what we're measuring actually distorts our device that we devised to measure it. So we've made up the whole thing, and what we're doing distorts. Does anybody recognize Heisenberg's uncertainty principle? Okay. So the idea is that you cannot measure both the velocity and the location of an object at the same time. And it's even thought in all kinds of semi-mystical or mystical or even scientific circles that this means that somehow the observer, is changing reality by looking at it. But that's assuming that observation is a pure act that has no physical counterpart, right? All observations are made physically. We measure them with photons. We measure them by bouncing light off of something, we measure them by bouncing something else off of it. We're talking about something so small that if you bounce something off of it, you're gonna knock the hell out of it. It's not like we look at each other and we see each other because millions of photons are bouncing off and we're taking them in through our eyes and so on and so forth. But when the object is so small that one photon is bigger than it, you're not going to get a very good measurement. If I tried to measure how tall you are by taking Gary and bouncing him off of you, we wouldn't get a very good idea, would we? No. So, and we probably would say, you know, we can't either tell where he is or how fast he's moving at the same time. It's one or the other. So I think basically Heisenberg's uncertainty principle is a certainty that we're getting close to where the discreteness exists in physical matter. Because we're not able to measure it with other physical things because we're getting too small. We're getting too small. So we must be getting close to the smallest, the things that really should be called atoms. Now, the reason that I bring that up in this kind of lecture is that these were also ideas that were gone into by Pythagoras and Plato and so on forth. They were very interested in math and interested in science as well as all the other things because they think all the answers got to include everything. And certainly emotions, our personalities, and so on. And to find that clear conceptual thinking was their answer. What's a clear concept that really can explain things?
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
So let's go back again to eternal ideas. We said that time is just this arbitrary measurement. At least I said that. Okay? So time is an arbitrary measurement. But what is it measuring? It's measuring the continuum of change, right? Change is continually happening. And we measure that process and we help ourselves find out what the causes and effects are by having this arbitrary measurement of time details in it. But there is no one period of time so small that no change takes place, right? Because the continuum of change is quadrillions of small things all going in different directions at the same time, and there's no way to have something small enough. So if we, instead of saying time and eternity, said the continuum of change in eternity, then we can have a clear idea about what eternity is. And if we think of it as the continuum of change, another thing, all those kind of mystical things about in heaven, you know, time is different. When I'm with my spouse, time is different because I'm having so much fun at the beginning of the relationship. At the end of the relationship, maybe it's just the opposite. You know. I'm glad you noticed. So it's all different over time. But if it's the continuum of change that we're doing, then we know that any conversation is a change, right? because you don't have words, then you have words. Even a telepathic conversation is a change. It's a process of change, right? So even any conversation, if a mind conveys something to you, then there's a change that just took place. That's part of the continuum of change. So anything that says that information came from the absolute, eternal absolute to me, it's got to be wrong, because there can't be any change that comes out of the non-change. Another thing that's very interesting about that is that you cannot have the start of creation either, because you cannot create change. You cannot make a change that makes change, right? Because how could you go from nothing to change without using a change to get there? So I think the whole thing has been very unclear to us, simply because we don't understand a continuum. We don't have too many continuums that we deal with. And so the continuum of change is really, we're always in the present. We're always right here. There's a certain amount of stuff. And when it used to be over here in relationship to each other, that's the past. And where it will be in relationship to each other, that's the future. But we're always right in the present. We're never outside of it. And when we remember the past, we're still right in the present. And so it's all the stuff that exists. It all exists right here. And it keeps changing. But it's a continuum, and we're just not used to that, and we haven't gotten a clear idea. But it does provide us with a very clear idea of eternity. Eternity is anything. What is eternal? The quality of eternity is anything that's uninfluenced by the continuum of change. It's always the same. It's no matter what you do, you can't change it. And pi is like that. Some other laws of physics are like that. Some mathematical rules are like that. What else is like that? There are other things like that too. And it's interesting that a lot of the things that are like that are actually what Plato called eternal ideas. So he had a gut feeling, because he didn't explain it clearly, but he had a gut feeling that these were the things that were actually the absolutes. He believed in the absolute as well, absolute good. But the things that were really interesting to him were these concepts that were the inherent patterns in the way we think. And if we could get that, we would get something of extreme value. So he went after it. Now, let's use his idea to make another distinction. The distinction between those patterns and our culture. We'll call it truth for a second, those patterns of truth, but that has so many emotional connotations to it that I like the inherent patterns of things. Okay? So if you compare the inherent patterns, the unchanging patterns, to the culture, you'll find that almost every absolute truth that has been presented is really just a cultural artifact. It's really just part of culture. And what is culture? Culture is really what a group of people, through either one influential one or lots of people over time, what they agree on in the way that they want to pursue happiness, right? The way they want to pursue their desire. What's desirable, what's not desirable? What's a good thing for society, what's not a good thing for society? So I have an analogy for that. It's like baseball. If you didn't know the rules of the game of baseball, see, we're all living in this world and we don't have the blueprint, right? Does anybody have the blueprint? Did anybody come with it? No. Nobody has the blueprint. So we have to figure out what that blueprint is. This is exactly what Plato was trying to do. He was trying to figure out, what's the blueprint of life? So we go to a baseball game and we don't have the blueprint. We don't have the rules. We don't know what the rules of baseball are. How many games would you have to watch before you could deduce the rules of baseball? Thousands, right? You'd have to watch, and you'd be a very good observer. And you'd have to watch thousands of baseball games before you could say, okay, there's always three strikes and you're out, and four balls and you get to go to that first base over there. And then if you hit it under these circumstances and it hits the ground, you get to stay on the base. But if it's up in the air and somebody catches it before it hits the ground, then you can't go. And you have to go back and hit over again, so. So the rules of the game would take a long time. Now, if, say, you watched 5,000 games and you really thought you had all the rules, how many think you would have discovered the infield fly rule? Probably not. That's something you'd probably have to watch 250,000 games. After you had all the rules down, you said, there's a couple of anomalies here that don't operate the way the other things do. And then you might be able to figure it out. But it's not easy, to say the least. Okay, so that's my analogy. And the rules of the game of baseball are like these inherent patterns. Now, baseball is a made-up game. Yeah, so we're living some kind of reality. And nobody made up the rules. The rules are inherent. But the analogy is pretty good other than that one part to it. How you play the game of baseball varies by your culture, right? Do you like to play more defensive ball? Do you like to play, do you want to focus on the pitcher and make sure the pitcher is really good, or do you want to make sure that your batters are really good? Do you want to play offensive, defensive, or what combination of those two? And it has a lot to do with who trained you and what they told you was a good thing and so on and so forth. So our cultures are how we play the game, how we've learned to play the game. And, you know, if you are a Yankees fan and like the way they play the game, and they're always playing against the Red Sox, and you don't like the way they play the game, then you are always downing the Red Sox for playing the game differently than you play the game, right? And this is what we do with all of our cultures. You don't say, oh, every culture has come up with some really clever ways of being happier, although we have done that in the last couple centuries. You know, there's a lot of world culture developing, right? And a lot of that world culture develops because people say that kind of music, not everybody likes, but a certain group of people all like, you know, rock and roll, very popular with large numbers of people, et cetera, because it stimulates the right chords. So you have this situation of culture, and almost all cultures in their beliefs have this absolute idea that these are the rules of the game. Instead of thinking, this is my culture and our culture, our way of playing the game. No, they think it's the game. It's the game. Now, I say that even accepting the idea that maybe some of these ideas are right. Maybe if you are a Muslim and you do everything right and you die, that you get exactly the reward that they promise. That doesn't mean that that's the rule of the game. It still means it's the culture. Culture on the other side will be just as clear as culture here, if there is another side. And what's good about the rules of the game is that you can figure out something much more important than sticking to the rules. You know, if you want to be popular, say you're all alone and you really think that you would love to have hundreds of people cheer you every time you walk in the room. Sort of, I call it the two-year-old syndrome. You know, most two-year-olds, you know, get cheered when they come in the room, and people sort of regret that doesn't continue their whole life. And if they need this really badly, you know, they become politicians. And if they need it even worse than that, they go to Hollywood, or they're better looking, then they go to Hollywood. So but that attitude of wanting that cheering when you walk in the room, that idea is part of the game. It's part of the game. It's part of the culture. So let's just make the assumption, for the sake of the argument, that every single religious theory ever promulgated is accurate, not as an explanation of life, but as an explanation of a cultural group. It's different. Not absolutely true, but culturally true. Then it would be like, you know, you're sad and lonely and you're in LA and you walk by the Scientology office and they're trained, you know, to see that that's the kind of person you are, right? And they take you in and they start talking to you and telling you, you know, you kind of look sad, depressed. Here, let's give you a test. Oh, yes, you're sad and depressed. We know exactly what we can do for you, right? So how many have heard of NDEs? Near-death experiences. And lots of people, when they talk about it, they talk about the light, and they feel good, and that there's total love for them and everything like that. What if this is the other world's equivalent of the Scientology office? What if it's people who are there to try to get you into their cultural group, and so they want to make you feel as good as possible when you walk in the door? Because they know you're in a vulnerable position, right? Now, I hope that that's not true. But if it is, it's good to be skeptical when you arrive. I was very entertained by one NDE experience being described by somebody. He said that when he died, he was on a surgical thing, and he went brain dead for about 20 minutes. So when he died, he was in a coma for a month afterwards. He was greeted by two people. One was his guru. He had an Indian kind of guru, and the other was a female spiritual energy. And the female spiritual energy told him that he needed to come with her because they had a project that they needed to work on. And his guru told him, no, you still have things left to do in this life, and you should return. And he said that in his experience, they kind of went back and forth arguing about what it was that he should do for the next month. And then when he woke up, he was back. And so he did what his guru told him. But I really was entertained by that experience because it showed just what that was always my theory. It's just the same old on the other side. After all, where do they all come from? If there is another side, they all came from over here. So they probably all have the same personalities, the people you know around here, right? So what else would they do? They would still behave exactly the same way on the other side. So good to know. Good to know. Stay skeptical. If you like to be skeptical, stay skeptical when you go to the other side, because you might be in charge of your own life. One of the things that is a truth is that nobody can take your place, right? Nobody can think your thoughts. You're indispensable to yourself. If you stop doing your own thing, nobody else is going to step in and do it for you, right? And that individual integrity that you have is a very interesting fact. Very interesting fact. So Plato and Pythagoras and others have thought that the mind continues. But they didn't have all the same rules that others who think that thought. And maybe there are no rules. Maybe all those rules are all cultural group things. And that the only thing that's really true is that you're still in charge. Now, logic is much even better than that, because you can look at it and you can say, okay, there's only two possibilities when you die, right? People are afraid of death. But there's absolutely no reason to be afraid of death, other than cultural reasons. You know, you've been told you should be afraid because you're going to be punished for things. Now, when I say the logic of this, that doesn't mean you won't get punished, because if you belong to a cultural group who punishes you, and you want to stay in it, you can still get punished. But the logic of it is very simple. And that simplicity is, you die. There's two possibilities. Either you are dead or you're not, right? See, if you are dead, you don't experience anything. You don't have any emotions. You don't have any thoughts. You're not there to say, damn it, I'm dead. You clearly can't have that thought. And you can't be disappointed. You can't say, I thought all this time that I was going to go to heaven and now I'm dead and it's nothing. No, you're not there to make that conclusion, right? And so it really doesn't matter what you believe before you die. Because if you die and you're gone, that's it. And there's no reason to be afraid, because when you're afraid, what you do is you anticipate being unhappy in the future. That's what fear is. You're anticipating unhappiness in the future. And if you don't exist, there is no unhappiness. So there's nothing to be afraid of. Okay? That's one thing. The other side is that you still do exist. And if you still do exist, as long as you like yourself, your personality will still be very similar to what it was before. So if you like yourself, you have nothing to be afraid of either. If you don't like yourself, it's just the same as you've been experiencing anyway. So it's not that much different, right? Okay? So there really isn't a whole lot to be afraid of. I mean, and the irony is that the only thing to be afraid of is if you do exist. So the people who will be the most surprised on death would be the people who thought it didn't continue and are there going, hey, I'm still here. How'd that happen? I sure hope those guys over there weren't right, you know, because they said, you know, because based on what I did, I'm going to get. So you don't know. I mean, it's like saying that inherently you're in charge still. You're always in charge. Your mind is always in charge. And that is why, and I know, why would I even come up with something which seems so irrational in a lecture about reason? Because it really is the reasonable argument. One of the unfortunate things about Plato's radical respect for reason is that there have been too many timid people dealing with big issues. And almost everybody took the safe road and stuck to material things. And in just going after the material things, we can prove them. And if you and science in the 20th century was so effective at proving things and learning things that there's developed an attitude that if you cannot prove it in this proof way, it's really inferior information. Inferior knowledge and unprovable and therefore not scientific and therefore irrelevant to life. But what they have had to do is carve out an entire portion of life, like our emotions and you know, our family experiences, and so much so that, you know, your mother dies and you feel sad and they say, oh, you must have some chemical imbalance. Let's change that chemical imbalance. They don't say, you know, you're unhappy your mother died. Maybe you can be sad when your mother dies. Maybe the sadness is what caused the chemical imbalance? No. So it's really unfortunate, because any idea which is very effective, like materialism, is only good, or it's basically good in the area it is, and if you take it too far, you put it in areas where it really doesn't belong and it doesn't help your explanation, it ruins your explanation. And that's what Plato did, by the way. I mean, almost everybody with ideas does that. He said, these eternal ideas are really fascinating. How many are there? And he came up with lots of them. The idea of a horse. There was an eternal idea of horse. There was an eternal idea of human. There was an eternal idea. But, you know, we kind of know scientifically that, you know, humanity has got a relatively short time span, you know, under a few billion years anyway, for its existence. And so it doesn't need an eternal idea of a human being. No. No, but an eternal idea of a mind. Yeah, maybe. Maybe. And why? Because if matter just went by its rules, it would all go to entropy. And something is always pushing things back antiotropically. And the only thing that we've ever noticed do that is mind. Now, a lot of times people say, so there must be a creator. No, not necessarily. There could be trillions of minds. We've noticed that there are trillions of minds all pushing with their little way on little things. If you have a garden and you go out and something is misplaced and you look around, you know a gopher's been there or a squirrel's been there or another small animal or even ants or something like that. You never think, oh, that was just random actions of the dirt overnight, because the random actions of the dirt overnight would never do such a thing. If you went into a volcano and you were walking down, you said, I see there's something halfway down that looks a little weird. It looks kind of rectangular. So you go down there and you get up close to it and you see it's a television set, an old television set. And somebody had thrown it in and it rolled all the way down. It was broken and stuff like that. Nature would never, on the inside of a volcano, create a television set just by things, you know, rolling down and around. And that's the way matter works. And only minds put together television sets, even if they don't work. So we have this obvious fact staring at us. And Plato said his radical respect for reason is he said, there's got to be some order. Let's try to figure out what it is. And although most people don't realize it, the whole way of conceptual reasoning is a successor to this eternal ideas theory that Plato had. So that's what he did. And I want to leave you with something that's a sort of a liberating fact, and that is that if you do realize that you're the one who's indispensable to yourself, and you realize that the most likely thing is that that will always be true, then no one is ever in charge of you. Everything where people have told you that they're in charge of you is a cultural artifact. And you know, those of you who are parents, you know where it all came from. Because you want the children to behave a certain way to make your life more comfortable or to help them or in some way. And you have to have rules of rewards and punishments and so on and so forth. But if we realize all rewards and punishments are really just our way to manipulate other people to do what we want, we really don't need to extrapolate them out to the whole universe and say, somebody out there is going to reward and punish us for anything. Doesn't make any sense, because if it's eternal, then it's always in the continual present, and there is nothing you can do over a period of time that would make it even out or work out or make it more just or anything like that. The idea doesn't add up. It's a little like infinite number. Infinite number, everybody talks about it. In mathematics, you'll hear it all the time. Two opposing concepts. Number is a very specific thing. Infinite is a vague concept of, you know, endlessness, right? There is no number that's endless. There are infinite series, you know, where you can always add another number, another number, another number, another. But there's no such thing as an infinite number. It's used all the time. It doesn't exist. Because those two concepts don't coexist. And there's all kinds of concepts that don't coexist that we deal with because we haven't clarified them. And this is what Plato's idea was. Let's clarify our concepts. Let's clarify our first principles. And then we can do something about all this. So that's where I'll stop. And I'll take a couple of questions.
George, everything you talked about this evening has to do with the mind.
Yeah.
And the true living of life is done out of your mind, as I perceive it. And when you're in your mind, you deal with your senses. And we do everything physically with our senses. But this is not real life. Real life is out of your mind and out of your senses. And that's what people meditate for, so that they can relieve themselves of thoughts. Because when you're thinking, when you're talking, you can't, let's call it God as a universal term, okay, like infinite wisdom or God, or use that as a generic term. When you're in your mind and when you're talking and when you're thinking, you cannot access true life and living of it. So in all this talk, that's what I kept thinking about, like, well, all this has to do with thinking. When you're thinking, you're in your mind. And when you're in your mind, you're in your senses, and your senses betray you. The idea is to live beyond your senses. Talk to me about that.
All right. But if I talk to you about it, I'll be out of my mind. I now understand when I saw you sitting over there the other day and someone said, yeah, that's Gary, he's out of his mind. Now I understand what they were talking about. So a few of you may have heard my lecture here. It's now 7 years ago, 2011, called Patterns in Our Personalities. And that was different patterns that are inherent in our minds, in the way that we do things. And I would say that this same concept comes from a very similar a set of experiences in meditation and the traditions in India and so on and so forth about this absolute state of mind. And I think my conclusion, anyway, is that the experience of the silence in your mind and the expansion of your mind that comes from the meditation is another thing that has not been interpreted accurately, and that it's like anything else. It reminds me a little bit of like your daughter is in a musical at in fifth grade at the school. And they give the musical and the kids are all excited. They did so well, and they said, "Let's take it to Broadway." The excitement is so great when you're in the middle of an experience that you feel that it is everythingness. What I find, I go back to NDEs for just a second. Almost, not everybody, but a lot of people who have these near-death experiences say, I was given the information of the answers to the entire universe, and that was part of the process and to understand my whole life. And none of them can ever remember those answers. No, they never come back and give the answers. Now, I'm not complaining about it. I think that the people that they met told them, these are the answers to everything without justification. It's just their belief.
As you're talking, I'm acknowledging what you're saying. And what comes to me is what we're looking for is infinite freedom.
Right.
That's the secret, infinite freedom.
Liberation.
Yes, and that's the secret. And most people will never get there because they're thinking. And when you're thinking, you'll never be free because you're entangled with your thoughts.
And that's the Vedantic answer or the Indian guru answer. And Plato's answer is very different, and I'm on Plato's side. And that answer is, if you don't think clearly, you will never be free. If you don't think clearly about what's going on, if you don't end up defining what is real and what's not real, then you will never be free because you will be subject to whatever set of beliefs, no matter how wonderful the experience is. You will never be free because you will be afraid that you don't have it. And you will also say things like you just said, see, you are over here on the spectrum looking back and saying, these other people will never get it. But actually, a lot of those people probably live closer to the freedom that you're talking about than some of the people out on this end because of how they think about certain things. And I think one of the clear answers about life, once you have it, is it's not possible because you can never put yourself into another person's mind. It's not possible to know what they're experiencing and where they are and who they are and what they're at. We can exchange ideas. We can talk about things. We have language. We have even telepathy for a few people. But we can exchange things. But we cannot exchange this perfection. And this is part of one of the arguments about this mind. This, if you can merge with this mind and this mind can know everything and so on and so forth, what are the limits on the knowledge of that mind? There are very clear limits. There is no such thing as omniscience, and there can't ever be. I'll tell you why. You cannot know what it's like to speak English fluently and to know what it's like to not speak English fluently at the same time. You cannot know what it's like to know your whole mind and your personality perfectly because I'm an omniscient mind and I know exactly what you're like. But I only know what it's like to be me knowing who you are. I don't know what it's like to be you knowing who you are. I cannot limit myself to the point that I am you experiencing you. That is, nobody can ever know another mind. Because that's your experience. And as a matter of fact, how many of you think you know yourselves? So we don't even know ourselves. And we don't. And we never will. And we never will know ourselves. And so it's all right. The thing that Plato put out was, know the principles. If you know the principles of your personality, if you know the principles of what you like, what you don't like, and so on, you don't need all the details. If you know the principles of physics or math or any science, that's the thing to grab onto because those are the things that don't change and you can keep applying them in different ways. I think that's a good place to stop. Thank you very much. So thank you very much. So ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 116th year of enlightened discussion.